Coming to you live from Yo Mama's house, it's the Liberal Arts.
A podcast about postgraduate life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
By the way, your mama's really nice.
Yeah, she gave us Fig Newtons.
I love Fig Newtons.
Listeners, I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Rissa. And it's time for fun facts. I actually got a fact this time that's not about
Yay.
Me.
Not about your love for a very lovable,
I mean,
fictional character.
We could talk about that some more, but I actually want to talk about something else that is a fact about the world.
Yeah, please do.
Yay, we like
so
the world.
I think you guys already know the fun fact I'm going to lead with, which is there's going to be an eclipse soon.
Woohoo!
Yay.
So
I know, Cleo, you are extremely excited about this
eclipse. I'm very excited about
you
the
should
eclipse.
Be, because you will have a very good view of it.
Yes, I
not
will.
So much. Cool. So 2 weeks from now, there's going to be an eclipse. Now, these things happen a lot, but this one, people have been treating it kind of special because it will occur in a place where so many people can see it. A lot of the times, these things happen, and, like, the best place to see them is Antarctica or something like that.
The ocean.
Yeah, the ocean, mostly. This planet has a lot of ocean.
There's a lot of it.
Yeah.
As a scientist, I can confirm there is a lot of ocean.
But this time, the shadow will pass right over the entire United States, basically. Now, you guys all know what eclipses are, and this one is a solar eclipse.
Right, the moon is getting between the Earth and the sun.
Yeah, yes. So the sun, the moon, and the Earth all line up in a row. And you can see the moon pass in front of the sun. Basically, the moon casts a shadow on the Earth. That's what happens.
It's a really big shadow because the
moon
is very
big.
It's a
really big moon.
It's a moon.
Yeah. So this...
Wait.
What?
Is it, though?
That's no moon.
It is, though. It is the moon. So the moon is going to cast a shadow that's going to coast its way across the United States. All of the United States will be able to see it in part, and all of Canada as well, and Mexico. But if you draw a line kind of from the top northwest to the bottom southeast, and then move it only very slightly, that's who will get to see what's called the total eclipse, where you see the entire moon in front of the sun, and supposed to the moon kind of blocking part of the sun.
Which means I get to see it.
Yes, you will. So this one, for the most part in America, it'll be kind of like mid-morning, I think, something like 10 a.m., depending on time zones. And then if you're in Europe, Northern Europe, if you're very far north, like maybe Northern England and Scotland and Iceland, I think, will be able to see it like basically while the sun is setting or just before, but most of Europe won't see it.
Ha-ha.
I mean, there are a lot of eclipses that Europe sees that the United States don't. Oh, by the way, this is the first time we're recording while I'm in the States.
Yeah, you're here now.
Yay.
I'm home. But I had a couple other fun facts about eclipses. I was trying to look this one up, and I found something that was so funny, I have to share it.
The problem was
it requires me to pronounce a word. And I looked up how to pronounce this word, and I think I heard 10 different pronunciations.
Please tell me it's a dead language.
No, no, it's based on Greek, but it's just really funny looking. okay,
what's
so
the word?
An eclipse happens when three celestial objects line up in a line, right?
Yeah.
An eclipse is usually the words we use for this. But technically, the alignment of three celestial opposites is known is, I'm going to say this word right.
If you look straight at it.
Syzygy. Syzygy. So the alignment of three celestial objects is called a syzygy. That's S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y.
That's a very good word, Rissa.
I know. And then one final really hilarious fact about eclipses and me looking them up. So one of the cool things about eclipses is that we can predict when they're going to happen. Like, we know this is going to happen, and we can predict really far away in time when these are going to happen and where they're going to happen and things. So
Three cheers for math.
Sorry?
Three cheers for math.
Yes, three cheers for math. But, so I was on Wikipedia looking up this eclipse, and I found out that Wikipedia has a full list of every solar eclipse that will occur from now until the year 3000.
God bless.
Just because they can. Strangely, they don't, they go back only to the year 0 AD. They don't go into the BC.
Oh, well, that's just quitter talk.
I know, right? But I was just really, I was just laughing. Because it's like, so we don't know anything about the year 3000, but we know exactly when and where the eclipses will occur. It's just, I think it's really cool that we know that kind of stuff. It makes me
think. Unless we destroy the moon by then.
Oh.
It's okay. They'll lay a new one.
If the Earth is still here, and the Moon is still here, and the Sun is still here, hopefully there will be eclipses in the year 3000.
Well, there's not much we can do to the Sun.
You say that. Big. That's Twitter talk.
You say that.
Not with that attitude. Anyway, you just get a lot of cool stuff about eclipses. You get a lot of awesome pictures, and you get to play with cool words like syzygy and penumbra and things. Anyway, I can, if you want me to just keep talking about eclipses, I can, but I think someone other than me has a much more interesting thing to talk about at some point.
Oh yes, I am very interested to hear about today's colloquium, Cleo.
Yes, it's gonna be fun, I hope. I told you guys this is gonna be a test of my teacher in training skills to see if I can make doctrinal disputes sound interesting.
I'm always interested in doctrinal disputes.
Doctrinal disputes. Are we still talking about Turkey?
We are talking about Turkey.
The doctrine of Turkey?
No. Not the doctrine of Turkey.
Just what all of them believe. All of them.
All of everyone. Them.
They are a homogenous whole.
Yes. So, yes, today we are going to continue our discussion of history in Turkey, or the geographical area also known as Asia Minor or Anatolia. Today, what is mainly the modern nation state of Turkey. However, today we are going to talk about something that I did not associate with Turkey at all growing up and still until I really started studying history, and that is church history.
Oh, fun.
Interesting. Wait, yeah, I very much associate church history with, like, Israel, and then, like, skip a few hundred years, and then
Germany.
Italy.
Yeah, Italy, Germany.
Oh.
See, Italy and Germany. Okay, yeah, I was thinking Catholic.
So,
I'm not that Protestant.
Because, like, doesn't a large portion of the Book of Acts occur in Asia Minor?
It does.
I mean, now that I'm thinking about it, yes.
It does. We're going to talk about that a
little
bit.
You usually just skip to, like, Luther.
Yeah, there was Jesus, and then there were some apostles, and then Martin Luther came in and saved the day.
I think that's actually how some people teach it, like, for real.
No, but it is. It is
grossly apparent that we are all Protestant.
It really is.
I had a theology professor in Lithuania tell us, she's like, if your idea of Christianity starts in... with the Protestant Reformation, you have a problem.
Yes, this is true.
For sure.
So we are not going to start with the Protestant Reformation.
Thank
we
God.
Are going to start with the most famous missionary to ever come from Turkey. And that is...
Oh, wait. No, I know this one. It's Paul, isn't it?
It is Paul.
Yeah!
He was from there?
He wasn't from Israel? No, Paul was born in the city of Tarsus.
Yeah.
Which is in Turkey. He was born a Roman citizen. While he did eventually go to study in Jerusalem, his earliest education took place as a Jew growing up in the city of Tarsus. I actually wrote a paper on this in undergrad, so I have my little 5-page paper here that I'm looking at because I kept it because I just found it completely fascinating. At least from my mindset, when I think Paul's first missionary journey took place almost entirely in Asia Minor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for some reason I always had it in my head that when he did this, he was doing foreign missions. He was going to this place he'd never been before, with these people he didn't know much about. And the fact was, he lived there.
That is a very good point. I don't know why I didn't think of that.
And two fun things about the Apostle Paul. One is that he was a tent maker by trade.
Okay,
and right. As he went around on his missionary journeys, he talks about, in the letters that he wrote, how he supported himself by tent making. And he learned that in Tarsus was a center of tent making.
Huh. Oh.
I didn't think of that as, like, an industry that could support a city.
Yeah, and so I have a little quote here. It says, Tarsus was especially famous for the manufacture of goat's hair felt, out of which tent cloth, hangings, blankets, clothing, belts, and saddles were made.
Whoa.
But it was a city of trade and learning with a protected port for ships and man-made routes that enabled it to connect with other more mountainous regions to the north. And then one other thing that Paul is known for is that he liked to go into cities and talk to philosophers. And
because we're the best people to talk to.
Wow.
Clearly,
no, that was completely
why.
Sarcastic. We are the opposite of the best people to talk to.
And, well...
So you're saying that it was a ministry because you're all the worst.
Probably.
Why is it important that Paul talk to philosophers?
Well, again, I'm reading from my paper. It says, Tarsus was a university town. One of the most famous exports of Tarsus was scholars. In particular, Tarsus was famous for philosophers, yes. And especially for philosophers of the Stoic school. Stoics held that pervading the whole of the material order was reason and purpose, logos, itself divine. It was this divine reason that ordered the regular motions of the heavenly bodies, the rotations of the seasons, and the exact performance by natural objects of their appointed functions. And Paul taps into this in some of his writings. He taps into Stoic ideas, and he says, for example, about Christ, for him all things were created, he is before all things, and in him all things hold together.
Ooh, yes. I love that.
Okay, so yeah, that's kind of my short blurb on Paul. Moving on to one of the most other famous sons of Turkey, the Emperor Constantine.
Oh, hey, he was from there?
Hey.
Yes. So, the Emperor Constantine. This is confusing. All right, this was about giving me a headache yesterday. I was trying to get this family line sorted out. Constantine the Great was born around 280 and died in 377.
Okay.
So, if you remember when we talked about the classical period in Turkey, at this point, the Roman Empire has kind of informally split. It's still one empire, but the eastern half of the empire, with the capital in Byzantium, is being ruled by kind of a extra emperor, if you were to call him that.
My co-emperor.
The co-emperor, yeah. The co-emperor. So in 305 CE, the emperor in the west in Rome is Diocletian. Diocletian is responsible for one of the worst persecutions the Christian church saw across the empire, east to west.
Yikes.
The emperor ruling in the east in Byzantium is Maximian. Okay. And both of them abdicate to their deputy emperors.
Wow. That's bizarre. Is it because they didn't want to get murdered?
Maybe.
That's why I'd abdicate
I'd abdicate to keep from getting murdered. Both of them abdicate to their deputy emperors. And so Galerius becomes emperor in the east, and a man named Constantius becomes emperor in the west.
No, that's not Constantine, or it is?
No, Constantius is Constantine's father.
Okay.
And just when
please,
you think
please.
Their names
Constantius
are...
Constantius is my father.
Yes. Just when you think those names get confusing, after Constantius and Galerius die, we have a battle of succession. Succession. Oh, no. Basically, the empire in the east comes under the rule of a man named Licinius, and in the west, we have a power struggle between Constantine and Maxentius, the son of Maximian.
Oh, wow.
Like, stop okay. naming your kids Jack if your name is Jacob. It's confusing. The best part is Constantine is married to Maximian's sister. No, to Maxentius's sister.
Uh-huh.
Oh, God.
Constantine
what the heck?
Is married to Maxentius's sister. And they're both fighting to see who's going to be emperor of the West. Maxentius is like, well, my dad Maximian was emperor before your dad, so it should be me. And Constantine says, my dad was the last emperor, so it should be me.
Wow.
Eventually.
Fight. Oh.
Literally. Uh-huh. Eventually, they meet up at this little battle in 312, known as the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. Long story short, Constantine is victorious in this battle, and he solidifies his place as emperor of the West, of the western half of the empire. But what is so important about this for the history of Christianity is that this is the battle where Constantine claims that he had a vision from God telling him to mark his soldiers' shields with the sign of the cross.
Mm. So Constantine at this point is worshiping Roman gods, yeah?
From what I can tell, yes. Okay. That sounds like there were catechumens present in Diocletian's court, even during the persecution. What? A catechumen is a person at this point who is not officially made a profession of faith, but they want to be part of the church and they want to learn what it means to be part of the church. Okay. They've not been baptized.
Supplicants.
Yes, they've not been baptized, so they're not considered official members of the church. So, according to the church historian Eusebius, who lived in Constantine's court, he tells the story about this dream that Constantine had. He said, about the time of the midday sun, when day was just turning, Constantine said he saw with his own eyes up in the sky and resting over the sun a cross-shaped trophy formed from light, and a text attached to it which said, by this conquer. Amazement at the spectacle seized both him and the whole company of soldiers, which was then accompanying him on a campaign he was conducting, and witnessed the miracle. He was, he said, wondering to himself what the manifestation might mean. Then, while he meditated and thought long and hard, night overtook him. Thereupon, as he slept, the Christ of God appeared to him with a sign which had appeared in the sky, and urged him to make himself a copy of the sign which had appeared in the sky, and to use this as protection against the attacks of the enemy. So Constantine takes what we know as the Kairo, which is the first two Greek letters of the name of the Christ, and he paints them on his soldiers' shields before the Battle of Milvian Bridge. And he credits that for being part of the reason that he was so victorious, that he obeyed the vision God gave him, and God enabled him to win.
Interesting.
Wow. Okay, so was it a cross on their shields?
It was the Kairo.
What is that?
It looks like an X and a P on top of each other.
Yeah.
Oh, that! I've seen that. Yes. Okay.
So 3 years later, at this point, it is still illegal to be a Christian in the Roman Empire, but 3 years later, Constantine passes the Edict of Milan, which does not...
Did he win?
He did win.
Okay, good.
Okay.
So it's still illegal to be a Christian. So 3 years later, Constantine passes the Edict of Milan, which does not make Christianity the official religion of Rome. Okay. It doesn't do that. I've heard that preached in sermons. It bugs me because it's not true.
I just imagine him acting edict saying, like, Christianity is not the official religion of Rome. It's like, gee,
but it's not illegal anymore, at least.
Right. So he just makes it not illegal.
He legalizes Christianity, he restores property rights to the church, and he becomes a great patron of church building, including the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, and St. Peter's Basilica in Rome.
Dang.
Oh! No way!
Yes.
So, he didn't make Christianity the official religion of Rome, but he did become a Christian himself, for all intents and purposes.
Yes, he was baptized on his deathbed. He was very favorable toward Christianity. He made it very popular to be a Christian.
Right. So it wasn't exactly, like, official for him, but, like, he was... I mean, you do what the emperor does, right?
Right.
It's interesting you say he's baptized on his deathbed and not before that.
That was actually something I read that was quite common with a lot of Christian emperors, because there are some sins you commit after baptism that basically make you an apostate. And there are some things you have to do in imperial politics that might cross that line. And once you're baptized, basically they consider that is your public confession of faith. There's no going back.
Right.
If you commit these sins after baptism, there's no hope for your soul. And so even though the emperor might consider himself a Christian in the course of imperial politics, he might have to do things that are not approved by the church.
Huh. Okay. What kind of stuff?
Sucks,
like murder?
But it makes sense. Yeah, assassinating folks?
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
because we're clear on the murder bit.
Yes. But he did... talked about, initially he was emperor of the Western Roman Empire. He was trying to build his own kind of famous capital city, Constantinople. The Constantine does defeat Licinius in 324 to become the sole emperor of East and West.
But he never moves back to Rome. He just moves Rome to Constantinople.
Constantinople, basically.
Now, was that a city before? And he just renamed it?
Byzantium.
Okay.
Constantine was, as I said, a patron of the church, and he was present at the first of the 7 ecumenical councils. Who wants to tell me what an ecumenical council is?
It's when all the church folks get together to argue.
Yes.
I was going to say talk, but argue is probably more accurate.
You got to remember, my personal upbringing, arguing is a favorable thing as long as it is not done in anger.
Well, then this were not favorable because there was a lot of anger.
Yeah, so why was he there if he wasn't even baptized?
Well, remember, he is very favorable toward Christianity, but also he's very favorable towards having a nice, peaceful empire.
Oh.
Oh, he's a big fan of not war.
Not civil war. He wants there to be no fighting. At this point, the very first ecumenical church council that we have is in 325, and it's the Council of Nicaea in modern-day Iznik.
Is that the one that semi-solidified the canon of the Bible?
Yes.
Awesome.
Nice.
I say semi-solidified because I know that there's... Yeah.
Right.
But he was present at the Council of Nicaea. Keep in mind at this point, there had already been a big controversy in Northern Africa, which was still part of the Roman Empire, called the Donatus Controversy.
Wait, Nicaea in Turkey?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Yes. But the Donatus Controversy spilled over to the rest of the Roman Empire because under Diocletian, a lot of people, under torture and threat of death, renounced their faith, including a lot of church leaders. After Christianity was made legal, there was a big debate about whether or not these people should be received back into the church, about whether these leaders should be allowed to hold office again, and whether the sacraments that they administered were valid.
Repeat Does your that. Communion count if it's made by a bishop who recanted?
Yeah. Okay. Does your baptism count?
Ooh.
Does the fact that you were ordained by this bishop and now you're a bishop, even if you didn't recant, does it count because he did?
Ooh, and that's like sticky. All right.
Yeah, there was a group of people. By and large, the church said, yes, it counts, and we should receive these people back. They've repented. Huh. But there was a group of people who said, no, we've stayed faithful, they have not, and it doesn't count. They were called...
And these were the...
They were the followers of the Bishop Donatus of North Africa. Okay. And this was such a big controversy that there were actual riots, people died... Whoa. And Constantine had to intervene in this. So Constantine has already had to intervene in church problems before. And now we have a new problem.
Yeah.
Arianism. So Arius was a presbyter or a church elder in Alexandria in Egypt. And he began teaching that Jesus is not the same substance as the Father.
Oh, Lord.
He is a created being. But because he is begotten, there in Arius' words, there was when he was not.
Nope. That's blatantly untrue.
That's not true. That is called a heresy.
Yep.
Wait, this is why they made all the updated creeds, right? To, like, explicitly deny this?
Yes, this is where we get the Nicene Creed, the Athanasian Creed. So, basically, this was starting to tear the church apart. So they call a council in Nicaea, and the reason that this is called an ecumenical council is because there are representatives from the global church. Also, fun fact, these 7 ecumenical councils are the only ones recognized as authoritative by the 3 main branches of Christianity, Roman Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, and by default, Protestantism, even though the 7th council is probably something that Protestants would be like, nope! But we'll get to that.
Interesting.
Okay.
So, at the Council of Nicaea, they debate this. Arius is there, and he's debating against another Alexandrian, the assistant to the bishop of Alexandria, Athanasius.
Ooh.
I know Athanasius.
Everyone should know Athanasius. He is brilliant, and I love him. They debate Arianism, whether or not Jesus was of the same substance as the Father, whether he was a created being, and The decision is that Jesus is of the same substance as the Father. He is equal to God. He is an uncreated eternal being.
Cool.
And so Arius is condemned as a heretic.
Do they kill him?
I don't think so.
Cool.
They're just like, stop listening to that guy.
Yeah.
I am not down with killing heretics.
I mean, he's excommunicated and anathematized and basically said, if you follow his teachings, you're damned to hell. You can't. Yeah, like, you're which not following the truth. So, by default.
Yeah.
That's the Council of Nicaea, but we have 6 more to go, and all of them are going to take place in Turkey.
Wow.
Every one of them?
Every single one of them.
Wait, what kind of time frame are we talking about? Like, was this
so
right after each other? Or
the Council of Nicaea took place in 325. The second
the last one?
The seventh took place in the 700s. So, Council of Nicaea, 325. The second church council is Constantinople. Modern-day Istanbul in 381. They are debating Apollinarianism, the Bishop Apollinarius of Laodicea, against the Orthodox Bishop Basil the Great, debating whether or not Jesus had a human mind. Apollinarius said that Jesus did not have a human mind, that the divine logos took the place of a human mind, and Basil was like, he was human, he had a human mind.
Right.
So basically, they reaffirm the Nicene Creed, mm-hmm. and also reaffirm the equality of the Holy Spirit with God the Father and God the Son.
That sounds like good things to be doing.
Yes.
Interesting.
The third ecumenical council, you could debate whether or not it was actually ecumenical. Because now we're gonna, now this is going to get really, really violent. Because we're going to be talking about the Council of Ephesus.
Tell us.
The Council of Ephesus in 431. The key players were Nestorius, Bishop of Constantinople, and Cyril, Bishop of Alexandria in Egypt. So the whole thing started as an argument over the term Theotokos, which is a term that Orthodox used to describe Mary, and it means literally the God-bearer. And Nestorius thought this was not a really good term, and that it kind of confused things about Christ's human and divine nature, so he wanted Mary to be known as Christotokos, the Christ-bearer.
Okay.
Cyril didn't like that, and
what's the difference?
It's really, this is so confusing, because what we have today is, if you refer to Nestorianism, it's a heresy. It's the heresy that there were two persons in Christ, a human and a divine person.
Right, okay.
Which is not Orthodox Christianity. Not Orthodox. Cyril is accusing the Bishop Nestorius of this, and Nestorius is saying, no, that's not what I'm saying.
Oh, my.
Okay, so Nestorius may or may not have actually ascribed to Nestorianism.
Yeah. But he was accused of Nestorianism. He was brought up on trial at the Council of Ephesus. And basically what happened is Cyril and Nestorius go back and forth. They're writing all these angry manifestos about theology. And finally, Cyril just snaps. He writes the Bishop of Rome. He says, Nestorius is teaching heresy. This is what he's teaching. He's teaching that there are two persons in Christ, and he needs to be excommunicated. Please let me excommunicate him. Wow. And the Pope writes back and says, that sounds bad. Excommunicate him.
Okay.
So that didn't really seem like a council.
They call this council in Ephesus, and it's supposed to be ecumenical, because at this point, all the bishops around Christendom are divided. Some of them are siding with Cyril, you've got some of them siding with Nestorius, so they call this council to meet in Ephesus, and they get there, and half the people aren't there yet.
Oh no.
But Cyril manages to take over and start the council anyway.
Oh, Cyril, no!
Unfortunately, half the people who aren't there were actually coming to support Nestorius in this whole council. What happens is that the council that's assembled condemns Nestorius as a heretic, strips him of his title of Bishop of Constantinople. So his buddies get there and they're like, wait a second, you guys had the council without us? That's not a valid council.
This isn't very ecumenical at all.
We're excommunicating all of you and having our own council.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, no!
Yeah, and the whole time, letters are flying back and forth to Constantinople, back and forth to Rome. And my favorite part, Extra Credits has a great video on this, and my favorite part of something I saw on there was that remember Nestorius is from Constantinople? He has a lot of friends in the emperor's court. And so they basically sabotage the mail to keep Cyril's letters to the emperor in Constantinople from getting to the emperor. Because Cyril's writing to the emperor in Constantinople, this is a heretic, and the pope has already excommunicated him. Please end this. Just please. And but his letters aren't getting through. He had to have someone dress up as a beggar and stuff a letter in a hollow staff and sneak it into the emperor.
What?
Yeah. So Nestorius has condemned and exiled as a result of this council. The churches who followed his teachings were also excommunicated and regrouped under their own leadership. They are known as the Church of the East. They are prevalent today in places like Iraq and Persia, and this is where we have records of what are called the Nestorian churches. They went all the way to China.
Dang.
Very active missionaries, very large churches. At one point, one of the Nestorian leaders, the Bishop of Baghdad, Timothy, presided over probably 1/4 of the world's Christian population.
Holy crap. Wow.
But was not considered, they would not have been considered Orthodox Christians by the Orthodox and the Catholics. And I believe at this point they have been accepted back into communion with the Catholic Church. And there's a lot of debate among scholars about what Nestorius himself actually believed, if he really did believe this heresy that he was accused of.
Cool.
But that's the Council of Ephesus, also known as the Robber Council. Third Church Council in Chalcedon, modern-day Katakoi, I think I'm saying that right, in 451. Chalcedon,
that's a fun name.
Yeah, Chalcedon was another part of the Kingdom of Pergamum, initially deeded to Rome. So the Council of Chalcedon is where the majority of Christians today get their
eyes. My favorite dinosaur.
That's not a dinosaur! What?!
Chalcedon.
I'm sorry.
Is there a Chalcedonosaurus?
I don't think so.
I want you to design a dinosaur named Chalcedon, please.
You don't just design dinosaurs. They were living animals.
No, I know, okay. No, I know. But if
you
there
could,
was one
but
named
it's a very bad idea.
What would it look like? That's what I'm saying.
Anyway, the Council of Chalcedon came apart because a man named Eutyches decided to overreact to Nestorianism.
Okay, that's good.
Well done.
By teaching that there's only one nature in Christ. The Christ's human nature was overwhelmed by his divine nature to the point that became, as he called it, a drop of honey in the ocean.
So he's arguing that if he was human, it wasn't, like, it was statistically relevant.
Yeah, basically.
That's also incorrect?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, they called church council over it. Basically what happened is they had a re-condemnation of Nestorius' teaching along with condemning the teaching of Eutyches.
Wow.
And this is where we get the definition of Chalcedon, which does refer to Mary as the God-bearer. So again, you see that reaction against Nestorius.
Interesting.
And okay. Refers to Christ as being recognized in two natures without confusion, without change, without division, and without separation. The distinction of natures being in no way annulled by the union. So, Eutyches was condemned, the churches who followed him were excommunicated, and this is where we get the Monophysite churches of Egypt and Syria. Second Council of Constantinople,
which is
the fourth council overall, in 533, the Empress Theodora, wife of Justinian the Great, encouraged him
to call
a council. She is cool. She was also a Monophysite. Monophysitism didn't go away. It didn't
go
away.
So wait, that was the people that just got condemned, right?
Yes. And so what she did was she's like, you know what? The Council of Chalcedon didn't condemn all the works of Nestorius.
Oh, Lord.
I think we've got some wiggle room here. So she convinced Justinian to call the council in the hopes that this council would say, wow, the Chalcedonians really didn't care that much about truth if they didn't condemn all of Nestorius. I bet that's not even a valid council, which means our excommunication isn't valid, and we're still good.
Theodora, no!
It didn't work.
Okay, good.
I can imagine.
Yes, it did not work. But Monophysitism didn't go away. In 678, we have the fifth church council, the third council of Constantinople, against the belief called Monophysitism, which is basically kind of Monophysitism light, the belief that Christ only had one will, a divino-human will.
Oh, Lord.
And the Orthodox Christians were like, no, he has two wills, a human and divine, but they always act in harmony.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Okay, you're groaning a lot as if this is a big deal, and I'm not super seeing it.
Yeah, so no, that's what I'm groaning about, the fact that this was such a big difference that we had to do whole council and things.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, yeah. They did. So, the first six ecumenical councils are things that if you're Catholic, if you're Orthodox, if you're Protestant, you're basically not going to argue about this. We all accept the same first six. And then you get to the second council of Nicaea.
Uh-oh.
All right. In 787, which was called to resolve the iconoclastic controversy.
Okay, tell me what that means.
So, iconoclast means icon breaker.
Literally,
icon breaker.
Okay.
So, icons are works of art used in religious ceremonies by Catholic and Orthodox Christians to help them focus on truth. Basically, the Orthodox refer to them as windows to heaven, this way of connecting through art to the spiritual reality.
Is this going to be a those guys are making idols kind of argument?
It is.
Oh, good. Okay.
So in 726, Emperor Leo III of Byzantium decided he was not a fan of icons, and no one would listen to him, so he decided to go really public with this belief and smash an icon of Christ. A very famous and popular...
Cool! Temperance movement style.
Oh,
fantastic.
Yes. And he started a riot.
Imagine. And they were considered, like, kind of holy,
They
right?
were considered holy. It was the same as St. John of Damascus said, it would be like if you have a coin with the emperor's face on it and you step on it on purpose. So he started riots, but this didn't really change his mind. In fact, it solidified his point of view. And Leo had been going back and forth with a pope in Rome, basically saying, yo, pope, icons are bad. And the pope wrote back and was like, no, Leo. You don't even understand, and it's none of your business anyway. You're emperor, not the pope.
Okay.
And Leo wrote back and was like, no, you don't understand. They're really bad. And the pope writes back and says, no, they're not. Mind your own business, Leo. And Leo's like, they're so bad, I'm going to come to Rome and break them all.
Frick, Leo!
So... They called the council to just talk about did other people support the emperor's point of view?
There were some who supported his point of view, and because they were backed by the emperor, they got to run around doing things like raiding monasteries and breaking all the icons, burning down the shrines and tombs of saints, murdering monks who would not give up their icons, and all kinds of things. This went
this
on
is not
for,
the way to go about this
no,
business.
This went on for 60 years.
Oh my gosh! Okay, so I see why now there's a council about it.
It's a flat-out civil war at this point. And all the people, but the majority of Christians are holding on to the icons. They believe that these are a necessary, important part of worship. Finally, in 780, there's a new emperor, and he's too young to take the throne. So his mother, the Empress Irene, is ruling as regent, and she's... I don't know. I have in my notes here that she called the Second Council of Nicaea to end this madness.
Nice.
Hey yo, everyone, do something about this.
Because at one point, the iconoclasts had called their own council. They called it ecumenical, although like the Council of Ephesus, the other side wasn't there. And
very terrible.
They anathematized everyone who held to the veneration of icons. And basically said,
you can't all just get
Christians.
Together and decide to excommunicate someone. That's not how it works.
That's not how the Force works.
But that's how it worked. And so Irene called this council to try to sort this out. And eventually they came to the conclusion that icons are a part of Christian worship. They deserve respect and veneration, but not the adoration or worship that is due to God.
Okay.
Of course.
And so that is the position still held by the Orthodox and Catholic churches. Obviously not the Protestant churches. They're kind of iconoclastic. But,
You know, they said that they were
Like, did they say they were important or, like, necessary?
It was one of those things that was so embedded in Christian practice that they couldn't imagine not doing it.
Interesting.
It's like folding your hands when you pray.
Yeah, it's...
Right?
You know, if someone it's came like just something you said, do. I'm going to cut off your hands if you don't stop folding your hands when you pray. But they really...
It's like, why?
But they really did believe that the icons helped you connect to the spiritual realm.
Interesting.
The ones that have been blessed and were used... for worshipful purposes, they did have the ability to help you understand and connect to the spiritual realm.
Interesting.
You know, I do understand that. I feel like, especially in a time when very few people are literate, especially comparatively, like using pictures to draw your attention to and retell the stories that are in scripture, that's really important, right?
Right. And one more thing that I wanted to talk about. Before ending this colloquium, this is going to have to be a two-part colloquium because there's a lot.
Okay.
But I want to talk about one very important topic before I go mm-hmm. and turn this over to you, science. I wanted to mm-hmm. talk about how to get on the naughty list at Christmas.
Ooh!
We're talking about Santa Claus, eh?
We're talking about Santa Claus. Now, if I were to ask you, how do you get on the naughty list at Christmas, you might start quoting, you know, I'm getting nothing for Christmas. I ain't been nothing but bad. Something like that. What would you say? What would
you couldn't pay ages? Me to? You could not pay me to quote that song. I'm sorry. Yes. No.
You can pay me.
I would never do that.
Well, I'll
do
I can
quote
you.
That song.
What'd you say, Russ?
I know one way. I just did. It's talking with your mouth full while you're recording a podcast.
Yes.
Nice. You're on the naughty list now.
How else would you get on the naughty list?
Being mean to your siblings.
Pulling pranks on the teacher.
Pulling pranks on the teacher. Yes. But there is one very specific way that you can get to the very top of the naughty list.
Kill someone.
Be an Aryan.
What?
Oh.
Be an Aryan.
Really?
See, what I'm talking... The person I'm talking about here is the man who inspired the legend of Santa Claus, St. Nicholas of Myra.
Nice.
And Myra, if I'm not mistaken, is in Turkey.
Myra is in Turkey.
Yes. Imagine. Everyone, Santa Claus is brown.
Yep.
Yay!
Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus, and he is brown.
Nice.
Or he was. St. Nicholas, the blessed St. Nicholas, the wonder worker, Bishop of Myra, lived from around 270 to 343. He was imprisoned under the persecution by Diocletian, and this led to him being very beloved by his parishioners, because unlike many leaders of the church, he was actually suffering with them and not recanting.
Nice.
He was a very generous person. He was known as someone who cared very much for children. He was also, and this is kind of a dicey church tradition, a lot of people would say that this is just legend, but he is claimed to have been present at the Council of Nicaea.
Okay.
Where they're debating the nature of Christ versus the Arians, who say that Christ is not God.
Okay, forgive me, this does not sound like Santa Claus.
Well, it doesn't sound like the Santa Claus you're used to hearing about.
Okay, so he wasn't arguing for Arianism,
no,
right?
No, he was arguing against Arianism. In fact, at one point, the legend goes, Arius, or another Arian, stood up and flat out began to deny the deity of Christ, and Nicholas was so overcome by love for Christ and righteous indignation that he walked over and slapped him in the face.
Nice.
Take that!
Yes. So Constantine, who has already had to deal with way too much Christian violence in his short term as emperor, in like the last decade of being emperor, no more violence. How dare you be so violent right here? I'm sitting right here, guys. True Nicholas stripped him of his title of bishop, took away his copy of the Gospels, and threw him in prison.
What? Santa Claus was in jail for slapping a man?
So much wrong.
Why isn't
this
in all the storybooks?
But the story goes, that night as he is in his prison cell, the Blessed Virgin Mary and Jesus come to him and say, "Why are you in prison?" And Nicholas says, "Because of love of Christ." And so they restore to him his copy of the Gospels, and when the guards come the next morning, he's standing there dressed as a bishop with a copy of the Bible. And everyone's like, well, we messed up on that one.
So they just said, forget that about...
They restored him to his position. The emperor restored him to his position and set him free. And, of course, Arius was condemned to the Council of Nicaea as a heretic. So there are all kinds of wonderful memes on the internet about this. And I can try to post some.
Oh, Lord.
I love them.
Post church history memes.
I love them so much. But this is actually in the Greek and Eastern Orthodox Church. This is an event that is commemorated in church iconography.
Nice.
But some other fun stories about Saint Nicholas. Apparently, he used to go around giving money to poor young women who didn't have money for a dowry.
More like Santa Claus. Yes.
He would apparently drop bags of gold down the chimney. Yes. And sometimes, because people dried their clothes in front of the fire, sometimes they would fall into the socks that were hung up.
Oh, no.
But yes, that is how you get to the top of the naughty list.
Thank you for sharing
be
that.
Be an Arian.
I'm glad I've been warned.
Don't be an Arian and you will get presents for Christmas. That's nice. What you should take away from this episode. So, yes.
Will it just be money dropping down my chimney? Because, yes, please.
Only I need that.
That thing about please someone pay us, I meant that.
This just suddenly took an alarming turn to the prosperity gospel via Santa Claus.
Oh, no. It's Orthodox prosperity
Science,
gospel.
Science, please save us from this.
Can you talk about a post-pregnant problem that will not endanger our souls, please?
I'll do my best. Okay, so my post-grad problem, stems from the sheer force of my personality.
Oh.
That's not a post-grad problem, okay. Doll. That is a personal problem. But we'll try to solve it anyway.
Alright, it ties into post-grad problems like this. You all know I have a very strong personality.
No.
Yes.
And, yeah, and I tend to intimidate people. I don't mean to. I just do.
Okay.
I'm trying to make friends like a grown-up. Okay? Grown-up friends. And how do you make friends with people who are scared of you?
Like, are you in a position of authority over these people? Or just they seem put off by you? Like...
It's not that they're put off, it is that they're intimidated. Also, some of them, yes, I am in a position of authority. Oh, gosh. I told Rissa this already, but today I'm like, okay, oh, no. I lead the children's ministry at my church, and I have a new teacher. And she's like, yeah, I'm really excited to start teaching. I think I need to ease into it. And I'm like, oh, no, you can teach a lesson this week. And she's like, no. And I'm like, yeah, I know, it'll be great. In fact, I'll teach the first half, and you can teach the second half, and then it'll be great. Why don't we... And she's like, oh, no. I scared her. I apologize later. She didn't have to teach at all. But, like, I can tell that I am a little more gung-ho than she's used to, and for that reason she's intimidated by me, and I don't want to do that. I don't want to scare people. I want to make friends with people.
Specifically with that, she was probably already really scared of teaching, and then, so when she said, I think I should ease into it, it was like she wanted to ease into it to prove to herself something, and you just kind of said, nah, you don't need that.
Yes,
and she did.
I know this. And
oh, okay.
She did need it. Okay, yeah, she did need it, and I recognize my mistake, and I apologize for it. But I also want to make friends with her.
Yeah.
And be her friend, and I don't want to scare her so much.
You know what makes real good friends?
Tell me.
Food. Invite her out to coffee. Get lunch together.
How do you think I make all my friends?
It's food.
That's a very good point.
Like, the people that I knew in Oxford were not the philosophers for the most part. They were either A, people in my college who I ate lunch with every day because I ate lunch in hall, or B, the people at my church who I got coffee with. When I say coffee, it was mostly ice cream, but it was at a coffee shop with ice cream, so
that coffee. Sounds amazing.
I don't drink coffee, but we got a lot of tea and a lot of chai lattes and a lot of ice cream. And those are the people who I know.
Okay, follow-up question. Is food enough to counteract the sheer strength of my personality?
It's not food, it's time.
time. It's time. It's listening as well. And, yeah, just time, especially if you guys do something which is even sort of job-like, like children leading children's ministry together, time away from that, where it's not structured and nothing is expected of her except to hang out, that kind of time is really, really different. And I think that's, at least for me, how I make friends.
Also, for people that you are in charge of, getting out of a scenario where you're in a position of authority, because they're going to react to you different in an environment where you're the lead teacher or you're the person in charge. If you get them in an environment where you're on kind of an equal footing, that could also help.
Another thing, and I think you've already done this, that I found important, because I was a small group leader when I was in Oxford as well. When you make mistakes, the way you apologize for them says a lot about you and how you can interact with other people. And the fact that you already apologized, I think, is a big step forward. So, good job.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Just, no one's ever been scared of me, so I don't know about that part.
Related question.
Yes.
What if they're men?
Like men
who are intimidated
by me.
Men
who are scared of you? I mean, probably the same thing.
Yeah, like they're guys my age at church that I... Well, I also don't want them to be mistaken for, like, going out with, like, asking them out on a date. Because I am, I think, on the surface, the sort of person who looks like she would ask a guy out on a date.
Okay.
And I don't want to mistake that either. I just want to hang out with these dudes. They seem like cool dudes. They're musicians. They have a band.
You should invite them all to pizza at once.
All of the men and me.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, kind of going out as at least three people or something like that can help, I get. I don't tend to have this problem. that is a good question.
I would say ask more questions than you offer opinions.
I do, and I still sense that they're scared of me.
How do you ask the questions?
I just, earnest interest.
That could be part of it.
Oh, no.
Okay, so this is again a personality thing, but I know for me, if I ever get the sense that someone's interrogating me, then I tend to clam up. And I've had that before where someone was like, I really want to get to know you, and they just start firing off. So tell me about yourself, tell me about your life. What are your hopes and dreams? What are your deepest fears? Tell me about your spiritual Lord. Walk, and I'm just like I like pizza.
Yeah. All right, I see how the way I ask may be mistaken for an interrogation. I see that.
It's like, do you really want to know me, or do you just want to get all the information you can out of me as fast as possible?
I mean, yes, both of those.
I know this is a time thing, and I don't know how much time you have in your life. Is it possible to do a group activity with any of these people? Like a board game night or something like that?
Well, there's another problem, because there are four or five people that I would like to get to know. Uh-huh. The two that are my age are all men, are both men.
Okay.
The others that are not men are not my age. I feel like it'd be a weird group.
Yeah, that would be a weird group. Okay.
Yeah. How do make friends? How do make friends?
I mean, my only answer to how do make friends was, like, coffee, so... And I don't even drink coffee, so, you
Well,
know.
time is a valid answer. What were you going to say, Cleo?
I was going to say, does it feel like you're back at college with a making friends with guys things? How do we talk to these males?
Well, I do want to be respectful and sensitive from where they came from, because I know they were both grown up. They were both
they
raised.
Were grown up,
they both
but they're not now.
They were grown up. They both were raised in fairly Christian household, conservative Christian households. So
right.
I also, you know, I don't want to be the sort of person who, like, forget all the gender roles, come hang out with Hannah time.
But you also don't know
but
how
I
much
also,
of that they've
that's
kept.
Not my job.
Yeah.
It's like, interesting. I guess I didn't realize how different my group in Oxford was. We never, I at least, never had this issue.
Of people being scared of you or of
no,
hanging
no,
out
no.
with dudes?
Of hanging out with guys and stuff.
Honestly, I don't think it would be an issue if we knew each other a little better. The problem is if to get to the place where we know each other a little better where I would be comfortable hanging out with these guys is not that's the next step. I want to take that step.
Right.
And I don't know what it is.
Right. This is going to sound really sad for you, but time is a big factor. When I say I had friends in Oxford, that was after I'd lived there a year and had been seeing these people at least twice a week, kind of pretty casually, without any kind of structure between us, like, you know, being in charge.
Yeah, I guess I don't see them more than once a week. We used to. We had this young professional / college age Bible study starting up. Mm-hmm. We met a few times, and then it just kind of fizzled. And that I think there's like a variety of reasons for that. But I'd love to do that again. Why do I have to be the one to start everything?
Right, of course.
Oh, and that means I'd probably have to lead it, too, which I'm also not comfortable about, because what I really want to do is get to know these people, and okay. That puts me in authority again.
So, these guys, in which context do you interact with them? Is this...
Church. They're church friends.
So you just see them after and during and before service, or what?
Yes.
Okay. Do you... So what we always did, and how I got to know most of my friends, we had an evening service, and we would just always get dinner afterwards. We'd go find a cheap pub and get burgers. And that's how I met most of my friends. Could you get dinner or lunch afterwards as a group?
That seems like a sensible thing.
Because literally, after every evening service, me and my friends would just look at each other and be like, pub, 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 pub. and that's how I met new people, was someone would bring a new person and we'd be like, cool, join us at the pub, you know?
Okay, and there are plenty of hangouty kind of places in town that we could go to, so that's something. I like that.
What I would suggest is get a small group of people, 3 people, 5 people, and just say, hey, would you be free to get lunch and or dinner after service?
At least one other of them should be a woman, right? Like, that seems...
If you are concerned about that, yes. I don't...
I'm a little concerned about that.
Okay. If you are concerned about that, then do that. That's not a concern of mine, but I understand why it might be if someone else's.
Yeah, I'm in a very different but also similar position. Because my church is mostly made up of young families. So a lot of people my age, but they're all married with kids.
Right.
And so I would like to be their friend, but it's just like, well, I can't just say, hey, you want to hang out this weekend? Because they have small children to take everywhere with them. And,
but no, that's my biggest thing is just, invite people to spend time with you. And the best way to do that is to invite them for food. Whether that's lunch, dinner, or just coffee, or an ice cream, or something like that.
I think I can do that. Yeah, that is helpful. Thank you.
Did we fix it?
We solved a problem. Or, you know, got some good advice. That's good advice. Thank you, guys.
If I could throw one more thing out there in regards to relating to people. You have a wonderful personality. We all love and adore you. But in terms of seeing yourself as being overwhelming to other people, one thing that's helped me in thinking about this lately is that we all know the golden rule, right? And I was reading this book that talked about empathy, and it said, empathy is not treating other people how you would want to be treated. Empathy is treating other people how they would want to be treated.
Interesting.
I can't always anticipate that.
You can't always anticipate that, no.
Anyhow. Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
What are we into this week?
I have something I'm very, 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 very into. And
I know what you're
going to
say, and I'm into it, too.
So, to be honest, it's one of the things that got me into podcasts. It is the thing that got me into podcasts. I should rephrase that. This was the first podcast I ever really listened to. It's this podcast called The Adventure Zone that the McElroys do. And it's a D&D podcast, and that sounds like it has no right to be this good, if that makes any sense. Like, it sounds like you shouldn't have that good of a thing if all you're doing is recording some people playing a game together. But it's so good. It is honestly, like, I do not say this lightly. It is one of the most wonderful works of art, works of fiction, and uses of media, of a medium I have
ever been blessed to witness. It is phenomenal. I am in love. And I am so excited to see what they're doing with it. But this coming week, on I think the 10th, they're set to end kind of the first, what do we call it, movement?
It's going to be over. The story is going to be over.
I'm just dying. I am every single character in this story. And
I love them all so much.
Perfect and wonderful. It does not have the right to be as good as it is.
Yeah. Okay. This is a good time for some caveats.
Oh, yeah.
Caveat number one. If you really want to hear people really get into the technical gameplay of D&D,
look elsewhere.
Like, go watch Critical Role or listen to Friends at the Table. This is collaborative storytelling much more than it is playing D&D.
Which is why I love it.
Caveat number two. There's lots of swears.
Yeah, that's so true. It's not a PG show.
It is not even PG-13, I would argue.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's by language alone, it is very R-rated.
Yeah, without language, it's pretty PG-13. The language is a lot, though. It's not for kids.
Caveat number three, if you start watching it, or listening, I should say, it gets better.
It's pretty funny to start with, but it gets very good.
It gets very good.
Yes, you have to start at the beginning.
Please do. Do not start at the newest episode. Don't do it.
No, don't. Don't do it.
That'd be like skipping to the end of a book. Which, by the way, don't do. Just saying that right now. Don't do that.
If you, listener, would like to tell us what you think of The Adventure Zone, because we're absolutely always up for fangirling.
Please.
Or would like to send us pictures of the eclipse from where you are in the world, or would like to interact with us in any way, you can email us at theliberalarnts@gmail.com or contact us on Facebook as The Liberal Arnts or on Twitter as Liberal Arnts. We're everywhere, man. We're everywhere.
I love that we basically asked for people's views on The Adventure Zone, but not on our own podcast.
Yes. Please write.
If you'd like to leave a review of our podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening, we would also appreciate that.
Yes, please.
Thanks to Tristan at Vintage Lab Tech for our music, and special thanks to Caitlin this week. Not only is she our graphic designer and logo designer, she is the one who suggested the intro. If you have an intro that you'd like to suggest, you can email us or get on the Facebook page too. We'd love to hear from you.
And by intro, we mean the places we're coming from.
Yes, where we're coming from every week.
Thank you to all those people that Science has already mentioned, and thank you, wonderful listeners, for tuning in to the Liberal Arts. Until next time, learn something worth knowing.